Okay. Well, I have loads of questions, though. I'm sure everybody else does. Who'd like to start? Okay, I will then. It struck me before you talked it struck me before the meeting and while you were talking that there are sort of two areas here. One is academic, that is within history, biblical studies, archaeology, and the other is on the ground, because so much evidence is disappearing. Well, is being disappeared, actually. So much important evidence is being destroyed. Those are really two questions. I don't know which, if you...
But what's the question?
I suppose it's really, what do we do?
Well, I mean, one of the problems is, as I said, I mean, much of the debate, and I don't know how many people are familiar with it, but much of the debate about the history and challenging the history and, you know, ideas that these villages are indigenous, Jerusalem's actually very small, there's not really the kind of state there that's actually been painted, that in a sense has been in the ivory tower, it's been behind closed doors. Some of it's leaked out. The problem is actually getting that out to the public, so that then it becomes a much more standard narrative that you put alongside the other one. So there is an alternative view, because if people simply hear the standard view, they accept that basically as a kind of fact. It's very difficult to argue against it. In terms of the evidence, well, I mean, actually, I'm not sure about the disappearance of the evidence, because one of the ironies is that the way the debate actually developed was after 67, with the opening up of the West Bank to Israeli archaeologists, ironically carried out surveys actually looking for basically ancient Israel and the villages and such like. But it was actually then some of those archaeologists, people like Israel Finkelstein, who suddenly came to the realisation, well, actually, what we've got here is something very different. It's not evidence of these people coming from outside. What we've got are people actually, that these villages are growing up inside. So ironically, much of the evidence came from Israeli archaeologists, although the surveys under international law are actually illegal, and a number of the excavations, because they've got access to the excavations, much of the material has come through their excavations. But in a sense, it has to be reinterpreted, because there's still very much the case that it's through that prism of ancient Israel and the Bible, etc. So that's actually been going on as this kind of counter narrative.
Paul, Dick.
So can you say something about what is the nature of the biblical narrative? I mean, what is its origins, if you like? I mean, if it's not the history, then clearly it serves some other purpose. I just wonder whether you could say something about that.
Well, most standard views are that then the narratives as we have them are actually quite late and edited quite late. They're very complex things put together, and very much rather than being, I mean, they've been read traditionally as history. So people say, well, if you say, you know, this isn't the case, are you saying the Bible's wrong? Well, no. The question is that the way people have read the Bible is often mistaken. So many of these narratives, take the narrative about Joshua, for instance, and the conquest. It's a theological narrative about obedience. When you're obedient to God, you're successful. If you're disobedient, then all kinds of horrible things happen. You get kicked out of the land. So they're very much theological narratives which develop this kind of tradition, but have become tied much more to kind of historical fact by traditional readings. rather than, and if you look at them, many of them are very artful narratives. They're constructed in very literary ways, and have got all kinds of literary devices in them. They're very fine pieces of literature in their own right. So they're very powerful stories, but that doesn't necessarily make them historical fact, although they have some attachment to history and the past, of course, with some of the figures in them. But it's like taking Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities, where, you know, you've got historical references, Paris, London, you know, revolution or whatever, but an artfully constructed narrative around this. So you can read many of the biblical traditions in that kind of way. But that was also part of the argument that was going on at the same time, which was also very controversial.
Yeah, it's just fascinating the way, you know, what should be scientific theory and what is contemporary massive ideological and political struggle are just completely connected. I was on the a fact-finding tour with against the Jewish National Fund, and we visited this demolished Palestinian village, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name of it, but it's quite astonishing. You could see the walls, you could see the cellars, you could see all sorts of remnants. And the Israeli, I probably got the name wrong, the Israeli Archaeological Society had got all these labels over there, historical sites. And then there was this little thick plaque that said, this may be the place where ancient Hebrews escaped after the uprising Jerusalem or Masada or whatever it was. But it was quite astonishing. There was nowhere the name of this village, and you could see it. I mean, there were walls, you know, sort of 3 feet high, and it definitely existed. But what I want to ask is, it's clear there was a Palestinian presence. Who is actually winning the academic argument? Because we've all got our view of who's winning the political argument today, but who is winning the academic argument?
We're not. Well, I think, I mean, the problem is, it's the weight of numbers. I mean, that letter from Shanks complaining about, you know, European scholars to a group that became known as the Minimalists. But, you know, you can name on one hand those kinds of people. So it's actually a very small number over against the weight of tradition, conservative scholarship. I mean, much of the stuff is done in biblical colleges, faculties of theology, which on the whole tend to be rather conservative. I mean, Sheffield has a more radical tradition and reputation. But there was a point, I think, in, well, I suppose, the 80s, 90s, when I thought that the argument was being won, in a sense, in terms of more people recognising the argument, more people entering the debate, because really up until the publication of The Invention of Ancient Israel, no one would discuss the political issues. You could go to conferences. It was never, ever raised. That was one of a number of things which opened up the discussion. More people were coming in, more people were raising the issues. But I think, actually, in the last 5-10 years, there's been quite a swing to the right in terms of that conservative tradition, and responding to that in terms of saying, well, actually, you know, these are a load of radicals with a political agenda, and this is really the truth.
In archaeology too?
Sorry?
In archaeology?
I think, yeah, it's still that kind of biblical archaeology tradition is still the dominant one, although there are individual figures who stand out against that.
Okay, Shirley, and then you at the back, and then there are two over here. Yeah.
Just on the same question, really, I just wondered why certain views on our side, if you like, had appeared on television and also in the field of history. And last year, there was a series on television, don't know if anybody saw it, with a young Greek woman, historian, archaeologist, dealing with this whole question of the archaeology and the discoveries in Palestine. And at the same time, perhaps coincidentally, a Jewish friend of ours, who is Jewish by sort of feeling that because her parents were Jewish, she has a link with Israel and finds the whole thing very difficult to talk about, she actually recommended to us the invention of the Jewish people by Shlomo Sand, who is an Israeli academic who very bravely has published a very detailed analysis of the Jewish version of history, and points out, you know, that in Israel there is a sort of history department in universities and also a Jewish history department, which sort of, you know, raises all the questions. So I wondered why those two things perhaps had come up last year, and whether this was a sign of hopefulness in the development of the argument.
Well it is, but I mean, as I said at the beginning, I think, I mean, some of these things have crept out into, you know, some popular books, a few television series, that was one. But when you look at, in a sense, the weight against it, they are in a minority. I mean, I think it shows, I mean, it shows a changing of the attitude, particularly in Europe, towards the issue and sympathy for the Palestinian cause, so that those things can now get onto television. So I think, I mean, in that sense, it's a hopeful sign. But my sense still is that it's a long way to go. It's a tough argument ahead.
Okay.
The timing that you described for the kind of swing to the right in academia and the kind of move away from what you were saying, sort of happening in 1780, sounds kind of specific, suspiciously convergent with the events of 9/11. And I wonder if you would connect the two together. I've just been reading about the kind of manipulation of the descriptions of Palestinian freedom fighting into terrorism with that sort of series of events.
Well, interestingly, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily connect them, but interestingly, in terms of this argument, a number of people who were arguing against the kind of view, in a sense, that I put forward and represent, did connect them with 9/11, in the sense that, look, this is what happens and these people are supporting terrorists. So it was actually used in a negative way as part of the smear campaign, in terms of saying it anti-Semitic or whatever. One person arguing this, who writes a number of popular books, said, you know, this kind of view, this politically invested view, left-wing opinion, leads to fascism or 9/11, and equated the two things. But I think that swing to the right. I do think these things do mirror society. So particularly during the Bush era, and particularly in the States, you could see that swing back to very staid traditional views and very conservative views. There's a major international conference in biblical studies which takes part in the States every year, called the Society of Biblical Literature. And one of the things I used to do was kind of monitor, when I went, the kinds of topics that were on offer. And you could see that swing back to what was the kind of scholarship, say, in the 1950s, for instance, particularly during that era. I don't think it's improved very much during the Obama era, in terms of the numbers of people attending these kinds of things and the kinds of papers being presented and the kinds of views that come out.
Hilary? I'm not sure which of you was first.
Can I sneak in two questions? The silencing of Palestinian history, one of the things is about the silencing of the fact that there's a vibrant Palestinian academia, and I wondered what, if any, links there are between you European dissidents and Palestinian academia. And then the second question was, you talked about there not being destruction in some aspects, sort of post-67. I was in Jerusalem last spring, and I saw the creation of this sort of City of David. It seems a sort of massive tourist, what's the word, like a...
Theme park,
exactly, for American tourists. And I mean, obviously destroying Palestinian homes and communities along the way, but what destruction is taking place Distinguishing between which histories are being destroyed and which histories are being myths?
Well, I mean, the thing about the construction in Jerusalem, in the City of David, I mean, that mirrors very much things like the Holy Land experience,
yes,
in the States. It's within that same kind of, yeah, of tradition and that presentation of history. In terms of archaeology, well, I mean, lots of people make claims about the destruction of evidence, particularly for, you know, Islamic periods,
yes,
and such like. Now, I think it's certainly true in the past that in the 19th century, early 20th centuries, because they were focused simply on the biblical period, they did simply go through these levels and didn't record that much, and they were looking for, you know, ancient Israel and the biblical events. I mean, I think in more recent years, there's much more careful recording of all the levels, although there are a number of quite prominent digs which are very much focused on the biblical levels. That's what they really want to get to. But I don't think it's that kind of wholesale destruction as it was in the past.
And what about your links
I mean, the interesting thing is that in recent years there have been a number of departments of archaeology started up in the Palestinian universities, which are then conducting their own digs. So that, you know, there are obviously links with them, as with a number of Israeli archaeologists, but also particularly links with Jordan, Lebanon, Syria as well.
Thank you. Absolutely fascinating. And what you've described, I think, is entirely consistent with what you would expect a Zionist dialogue and a Zionist perspective and a Western imperialist perspective to be saying, that they would be looking to reinforce Israel and the state of Israel in the Middle East. I'm very conscious of the experiences that have been going on in the Arab world over the last 12-15 months, and the awakening consciousness that will be an integral part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested to know what the Islamic and Arab perspective is on the state of Zion and its relationship to the biblical past.
Well, I don't think I can answer the question. in terms of, you know, those groups, I wouldn't know them well enough to really speak on their behalf.
We know that the Israeli presence is justified, or they justify it on religious grounds going back. But there are also a group of rabbis that do not justify the existence of Israel on religious grounds. They too have religious ideas that contradict the ideas that the Israeli propaganda machine, mm-hmm, normally uses. Could you go into what arguments the counter argument is that this group of rabbis use, their religious ideas that create the contradiction?
No, I don't really know which group you're referring to. I'm sorry.
They do exist.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about Mitch McCarter?
Yeah.
Should I say what I know? No, that's okay. So, Ian Paffey talks about it quite a bit in his book, Ethic in the Palestine. So, these rabbis are basically non-Zionists because they think that the state of Israel could only come into creation when the Messiah comes back. And the Messiah hasn't come back yet. So, what Israel is doing is a man-made thing, not a God thing. So, that's why.
But that's why they refused to take part in the Israeli Defence Forces as well, in terms of it's a man-made thing rather than a religious thing.
Okay.
Keith, thanks very much. Just a suggestion in terms of the academic debate. We, mm-hmm, need to move outside pure biblical studies, say into, you know, theological departments, the church. One of the difficulties, it seems to me, is that the sort of where you would have a natural home for what you're talking about, where you have sort of theologians who would be sort of anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist, say like liberation theology, mm-hmm. for them, the sort of the Exodus is the foundational text. You know, John Sobrino said that Exodus is the primary event of Scripture. And if you look at Miranda's marks in the Bible, there's no quotations at all from Joshua and Judges. And a discussion with Desmond Tutu in the Journal for Theology in South Africa about 10 years ago, he gets very angry, mm-hmm. when the whole idea of Exodus is questioned. And so it's sort of the ideas that you talk about, it seems difficult for that to find a home outside. The same with feminist theology as well.
Again, one of the ironies is that that narrative of the Exodus and liberation was the thing which was used very much in South America in terms of liberation theology. But when you ask the question, well, who's being dispossessed here and whose past is being taken away, then they become very uncomfortable with that issue. It's only seen as a positive, never as a negative. But it's a particular problem for Palestinian Christians, of course, in terms of, you know, addressing that narrative and dealing with that issue.
Well, in the
yes, next to Shirley.
I don't want to detract from the discussion as to between the biblical interpretations and the scientific one, but I think you've made the point that people's expectations impose on what they see, and the discussion can be very much manipulated in the contemporary situation. Gore Vidal wrote a book, Permanent War for Permanent Peace, and it seems to me that Israel epitomises this completely, because it needs a permanent war in order to maintain the unity of the people. And those conditions, it's very difficult to start questioning some of the things that are regarded as the essence of the basis of the state. But nevertheless, they have to be challenged. Yeah.
But there are also, there are a number of Israeli archaeologists, mm-hmm. Israeli intellectuals who do actually challenge those things within that context, and much more difficult for them than it is for us sitting in this room to raise those issues. So it's not a unilinear society, though, as you say, because of that notion of the permanent state of war, then it really silences much of that kind of debate, and is used to prevent it going on.
Johnny.
Professor, you mentioned a letter that was written, that was in Kurt Harlett, challenging the Orthodoxy, and saying that actually the evidence is that, for example, the Kingdom of Solomon was just a sort of small tribal enclave.
Mm-hmm.
And you also said that New Greenwich comes out and says it's self-evident that this is the re-establishment of the ancient religion. In order not to get into one of these oh yes it isn't type arguments, but actually it's central to be able to challenge this, where can we find the evidence upon which that letter is based?
Well, there are a number of
reasonably accessible format.
Well, there are a number of books. Having retired, my memory is going to fail me at this point, but Israel Finkelstein and Neil Silberman wrote a book, remind me of it. Sorry?
The Bible Unearthed.
The Bible Unearthed, which again presents that, you know, much of that kind of evidence in a very accessible manner. Again, both Jewish scholars.
I'd like to ask a question about the Muslim world. Surely the whole region is surrounded by Muslim people, and who for centuries have been going to Jerusalem, and have got what shall we say, interest, huge interest in this area. And when the Zionists are making their arguments, it always seems to be the Jews on the one hand and their rights, and the people who live in the particular area that they have conquered, the subject people, as I call them. But there are massive interests besides the Western interests of America. Why is the whole of the Muslim world marginalised from all this? And how do the Zionists fob people off in this way?
Well, I think we have the power of the narrative, as I say, is because of these kinds of images, and that they are so deeply rooted in Western society, so kind of dislodging them is really very difficult. But one of the other problems, actually, is that this period, which is, you know, seen as the period when Israel emerged in Palestine, ancient Israel, and the, you know, the setting up of the monarchy of David and Solomon, which archaeologists usually call the Iron Age, has actually been abandoned to that kind of narrative. So if you look at histories of Palestine written by Arab scholars, for instance, and Said was a case in point as well, very often they completely ignore that period because they see it as being the period of ancient Israel. So it sort of, in a sense, it gets cut out of the history of Palestine as a kind of special period, which we'll talk about the period before, period of the Canaanites or whatever. We'll talk about the, you know, the Arab invasion and the Ottoman period or whatever, but this period in between we're going to ignore. Whereas the Zionist national narrative, it simply goes back from the present into that period, claims that period as some kind of special, and again pulls it out of the history of Palestine. The key issue is actually integrating that back in to a coherent history of Palestine and the region that shows that, well, ancient Israel was there in different forms, and we've got evidence about it at different points, but it was never this great overarching thing which completely subsumed the history. So it's actually trying to write that kind of narrative, which shows how it fits into what I call the rhythms of times, the way in which, you know, Palestine has changed over a long period of time. And that period, rather than being some kind of unique thing, is actually just part of the movements of history over a very long period of time, and is very similar to other periods. It's not unique or special at all.
Well, from an academic point of view, the whole thing is an absolute nonsense. I mean, you can't shut your eyes to a whole, well, centuries, if you like, of history just for your own argument. You can't do it.
But that's what's actually been done. I mean, I say, if you look at histories of Palestine, they're very odd things. They start with either the Arab invasion or possibly even the 19th century and talk about Palestine. So Palestine becomes something which is modern, which is part of the Zionist argument. Well, it didn't exist in the past. It's only a modern kind of thing. It's actually integrating that thing in to the whole stretch of history and seeing it as a history of the region over a very long period of time, that, you know, the argument will work. But I think.
Exactly.
Question over here.
Hi, I'm very interested in what you've got to say. I'm a Christian, brought up a Christian with RE many, many years ago, which is education history. And I bought and read your book about the ancient history. It's the first time I've heard a cogent argument talking about the construction. Now, it's an academic debate, and it stayed an academic debate. I don't think there's very much engagement with the faith community, and I've not heard this from within the faith community. I've heard it, and it's interesting that we're in this kind of setting rather than next door talking about it. Do you think, so the question I think is, why do you think there isn't this revisionist, shall we call it, view of what was a very nuanced sort of Zionist narrative which has existed all the way through, you know, Scotland, White Earth, into the 18th century. Why none of that has actually been really sort of resolved? and why we're still sticking to a very literalist reading of the Bible, which must accept everything from a completely literalist, increasingly literalist perspective.
Well, I think it's because of the power of that tradition and the narrative, and then people are very uncomfortable with that questioning, because it then raises for them, particularly in the Christian community and the way in which they read the Bible, very serious questions about how they read the Bible, the nature of their faith and what they believe. So it becomes a very difficult issue. When teaching in an academic department in the university, it's a very difficult issue often with students coming who have come from very conservative backgrounds, who are suddenly meeting these things for the first time. And, you know, it's a very sensitive issue in trying to explain what the arguments are and what the evidence is and how you construct the narrative. But I think it is still that power of that tradition within Western society and Christian readings which has that hold. And it's, as I say, it's very difficult to dislodge.
Do you think that's increasing, that particular view,
that hold? I'm not optimistic about the challenge, particularly because I think the number of people who are pursuing those kinds of arguments are becoming less and less. The kinds of people that Shanks complained about in his letter to Haaretz, I think all have retired.
Question here.
I wonder if. I mean, I take your point about various Israeli academics and so on, but I wonder if some of the, and I don't mean to be pessimistic because I'm not, but I wonder if some of the figures that were picked up on, such as the TV programme, which I think took actually a liberal Israeli line, it went, or didn't go as far as saying that even the war was a bad thing, she said we should all get along. That kind of logic.
Can you just speak up, please?
Yes. It's the television programme that was mentioned before, we took more of a liberal Israeli line rather than anything remotely pro-Palestinian, I think. But I wonder if some of the archaeology as well, say Finkelstein, he pushes it to the Hellenistic period as far as I remember. Does he re-inscribe a kind of Israel later on? You see what I mean? So is it actually that much of a challenge in a way? I mean, it challenges a traditional view, but does it actually challenge the idea of Israel being there in the distant past as a state and so on?
No, because I think... what has happened is that the kinds of view that Finkelstein and people put forward, which was seen as a kind of radical challenge, have been kind of incorporated into the argument and in a sense made safe. So that's one of the reasons why I don't think, well, I'm not very optimistic about the nature of the argument at the moment. So that then it's only one or two particular figures who were then attacked as being anti-Semitic because they raised the political issues, because he raised the question of, well, what's the implications of this kind of picture for the political argument? And, you know, once you raise that, then it becomes a really uncomfortable issue and very controversial. But they're not raising that argument. I mean, in a sense, it's an academic argument about the history, how the history is seen, but the implications for it are basically ignored and just passed over. So, in a sense, it becomes incorporated into the narrative and really made safe, I think.
Javid?
I think it was really interesting, the fact that, as you say, this sort of thing about narratives and scientific explanation, because in a sense, as scientists, you get trained to go and look at the data and try to interpret it rather than take a narrative with you. And as you say, these narratives are so powerful. I mean, from personal experience, I remember both my wife and I, although we didn't know each other, saying many years ago that when we went to school about Jesus being blonde and blue-eyed sort of thing, and it didn't make sense to either of us, not particularly. But being both penalised quite seriously, you know, saying, no, you've got it wrong, you know. Sort of going back and sort of thinking, oh, okay. So, as you say, they contradict or even common sense of what would have been the case. But and from my reading of it, which in any sense is very little, I do get the impression that people have sort of highlighted on certain areas. So I was unaware of Islamic history whatsoever, and I know some scholars have done a lot of work trying to unearth that. But I like what you were saying towards the end, which is that in a sense, there is a whole history, and rather than picking things out, which sort of gives the impression that one is being political, not that I have any arguments about being political, but the holism. I mean, recently Paul and I visited Biblos, and this was just a tourist thing, you know, written for very sketchy, but one of the things he immediately said was the fact that there was this multi-layered history there. And now, is there anybody that's trying to sort of, if you like, expose in a scientific way the fact this is multi-layered, and that you know, in that sense, not giving any prominence just for the sake of coming with an already ascribed narrative?
Well, I mean, there are some who are trying to kind of write those narratives, but, you know, it's a minority view. But there's also a danger about this kind of scientific notion, because if you look at maps, you would say, well, here's something which is objective. Look, here's the map, etc. But when you start to examine it, like Speed's map, sure, it's got all kinds of assumptions, yeah, etc., built into it. And I mean, that's part of the problem, in that what happened in the sort of 40s, 50s and 60s with this archaeology was it was presented as objective. Mm. I mean, we go and dig the archaeology, that's objective because it's stuff in the ground, and then we can apply it to the narrative, etc. But actually, what was being done was, you know, the narrative and the assumptions are already being taken to that stuff, which is coming out of the ground. You can't separate.
No, I mean, as you said, the context we live in often permeates that even more. So as we get more and more fundamentalist sort of religion coming in right now, it's certainly a time of Bush, and as you say, it's not improved any, you're going to get that being further imposed.
John.
Yeah, extremely interesting what you said. It seems to me that one of the things I draw from what you've said, and I think it's something I believe anyway, is that the really important period of history that we need to study and analyse that can unlock all of these questions is really modern history, is the last 100 years, is the period that you were talking about, the scramble, the competition between France, Britain, Germany for who was going to colonise and dominate that part of the world. And within that history, to analyse the nature of the alliance that was made between the leaders of the Zionist movement and imperialism. And if you look at the early leaders of the modern Zionist movement, Herzl, etc., they were not religious. They were not religious Jews. They were not trying to act according to some kind of religious mystical belief. They were politicians, bourgeois politicians who had absorbed and were trying to mimic European colonisation of Africa, the scramble for Africa. That was the context in which Herzl wrote his book, in which the modern Zionist movement was forged. And it seems to me that there are some, listening to the conversation here and listening to what you've said, there's some sort of really striking paradoxes about the Zionist consciousness, that they on the one hand affirm their connection with, their indelible connection over millennia with that part of the land, and yet at the same time they see themselves as the representatives of European civilization in the sea of Arab of barbarism, and that they try to prove their worth to the European imperialists and now the United States imperialists, at the same time as saying that they could not stay in Europe and the United States because of anti-Semitism threatening their extinction. Yeah. They've made a Faustian pact with anti-Semitism. They signed a deal with Hitler, the Havara, the transfer agreement. Balfour was the one who brought in the Aliens Act that shut the door of Britain to the Jewish refugees trying to flee the Tsar, that was Britain's friend in the tripartite alliance. And so you've got this strong theme of an alliance with anti-Semitism, with imperialism, against the indigenous population. And it seems to me, by actually exploring and analysing this, it is possible to completely destroy the claims of Zionism to represent the interests of the Jewish people. And that is the strategic way to actually destroy this, the Zionist myth, in the name of and in the interests of the peoples of the world, including the Jewish peoples, who are not served by this fake imperialist ideology.
I'll take that as a statement. Thank you.
Okay, last question, Jasvinder.
I was listening to your point. I wonder what, if you have anything to say about the Jewish and Christian Zionism and what the return of the Messiah is in relation to that.
No, I don't think I do have anything to say to you. No, I don't think I do have anything to say.
Maybe later. Chris, then, quickly.
I just find it really helpful, this idea of Bible as guidebook and title deed. I mean, that helps me really get my head around some of what you're saying, so I find that really helpful. I just wondered if you think the academic boycott is... I mean, I know what you're saying, and I know very well the ferocity of the how quickly people leap to call you kind of anti-Semitic if you raise anything about some of these issues. So I know what you're saying about that, but do you think the academic boycott is having an impact? And also, I just wondered, why have they translated your book in Korea?
Well, I think actually because there were a number of Korean students in the Department of Biblical Studies. Interesting, though, it was also translated into Arabic. But there's I'll come back to your question. The interesting story about that, in that it was published by Routledge. The rights were given to a small press in Damascus, Cadmus Press, who did the translation and corresponded with me and asked me questions about this, so I was quite happy that they were doing a proper translation. Just before they published their Arabic version, the Kuwaiti government pirated it and published it for next to nothing in the Arab world, and apparently it sold thousands of copies. No royalties of which I've ever seen, but the problem is it actually undercut the press, the person who, which was a small press, and he put a lot of money into this, undercut it. But yeah, so it was actually published.
You're the Kuwaiti government needs the money more than you do.
Arabic, yeah, I think, yeah. But they, so they did that.
The academic boycott.
Well, I'm not really aware of what kind of effect that's really, really having, because I think it's fairly patchy, actually, in terms of a boycott. So I think within our own subject area, it doesn't really exist. So in terms of biblical studies, archaeology, I don't think that's the case. So I think it has no effect whatsoever.
Okay. However, just a little note of encouragement on that. A group of American students have just persuaded their university to divest from partnership with Israel, so that is very encouraging. And in fact, 200 teachers have just signed a petition against their being forced to take their students on heritage tours of Hebron, Israeli teachers, and making it very clear that they see this as propaganda, not education, which is really courageous.
It's unprecedented. There are to collectively take such a stance.
Okay, well, obviously you're going to thank Keith for this really interesting talk. We have two announcements, so can we just make these two announcements and then we'll...
two things. I hope everyone's got a leaflet for our next public meeting, which is on the 27th, and it's here, 7 o'clock. So if you haven't got one of these, make sure you've got one, or look on our website. It's about the environment in Palestine. The picture is a picture of... go ahead.
It is two Palestinian speakers who are coming over from the Jordan Valley, which alongside Israel is the most endangered part of Palestine. Israel wants the whole of the Jordan Valley for itself. And Sheffield's the only one of two places in the north that they're going to be coming to. So really important meeting to come along to. And they will be talking a lot about the environment as well as the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and Israel. 7 o'clock here.
And the other one?
I haven't given out leaflets for this because it's more specific. The Palestinians have said it's very, very difficult for them to break the wall that's enclosing them. It's much easier for us to break in. And so what they're asking people to do is to fly to Israel at present. Anyone that wants to go to Palestine lies at the airport. You say, I'm on a tourist or visiting friends, Israeli friends somewhere. And they've turned people back. If you honestly say, I want to go to Palestine, you get turned back at the airport. The idea is that if a large number of people fly to Israel and say, we want to go to Palestine, two possibilities. One, they get turned back and it becomes incredibly obvious to everyone that, that Israel's operating a blockade. Or secondly, they get through. If they get through, then it's a tiny, tiny chink in the blockade. So it's a very, very public event. Now, to ask someone to take time out to fly to Israel, to either get sent back or to send to an Israeli jail, is kind of not appealing. This is a minority thing.
However, but we want a few volunteers.
It would be extremely helpful if someone from Sheffield volunteers. You know, we can help raise money. So someone that's either unemployed or but if one person goes there, then we can wave them off at Manchester Airport. That's the 15th of April, and it's an international event. I've got leaflets here. Even if you're mulling it over, do take a leaflet.
Okay. Very quickly, yes.
The Department of Business Studies at Sheffield has a conference in May to do with Zionism and Israel. And the two students are sort of organised. I don't know whether you want to say anything, Mike.
Very, very quickly, because we get thrown out at 9, which is...
Okay. Anybody can speak to this man afterwards. Is it open to the public?
Looks like it.
there is a link on the Sheffield PSE website for it.
Yeah.
And
Okay, and we did send round a sign-up sheet if you're not on our mailing list and you'd like to be, so that's somewhere if you haven't signed it yet and like to. But most importantly, thank you to Keith for a really interesting talk.